where it's managed, you go like, well, look at that in 10 years time, and that could actually be like, compound interest is magic, right? It can work for you. Whereas like, if you just pay your own salary in 10 years time, you're like, great, cool, I've paid my own salary. But you're probably better off just saying, you know, validation was fun, but you know, fucking maybe I just go work at McDonald's for the next 10 years and then. Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams. Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams. Surviving bear markets since 2022, still here. We put off last week's episode because of illness on the podcast.
There were shits all around.
There was a lot. I was raring to go, to be fair, actually. I was all right. But everybody else was ill. So I had a hot bath and read Master and Commander. So.
Oh God! Now you're reading it as well as watching it.
Oh, I'm reading the series. Did I tell you this? I got the whole series, like the books.
That's just sad existence.
$20 on eBay. That is a great deal.
It wasn't worth it.
That's a lot of content.
How many books is that?
19. Although, there's actually two more books. There's actually two more books. There's a 20th, I think, and then he died while writing the 21st. So there you go.
It sounds like you need the bundle of holding in your life.
Yeah.
You ever heard of this?
What's that?
The bundle of holding? The bundle of holding is like, it's like a Humble Bundle where you pay like $5 for like 30 books. And sometimes it's, and it's by the authors. The authors opt into it, right? Sometimes you get stuff. I tend to get all of them just because I'm a data hoarder.
Yeah, I was going to say that kind of feels like a hoarding thing. Like I remember getting so excited the first time I saw like Humble Bundles. I was like, fucking. And then they became a burden to me. I was like, I can do something with all these. I've downloaded all these games. I need to play them.
Explain the Humble Bundle. Humble Bundle.
Humble Bundle is it's originally for games where you pay like you get to choose how much you pay. It goes to charity, and you get like 7 games. So you get to pay $5 for 7 games, and often there's like good stuff in it, right? But it means that you end up ultimately having this massive backlog of games that you're not actually interested in playing because you paid extra for like just a couple of games that you wanted.
Yeah.
It's a good model, right? Because you're like, oh, I got 8 games. And then, you know, the next time you have a long train journey, yes, I know, don't fucking say it. The next time I'm on a long train journey, I'm just playing XCOM 2 again, aren't I? Of course I am, because I play XCOM 2. That's what I do on the train.
When you're like, hey, which version of Lemmings am I going to play today?
Do you actually play Lemmings?
No, it just seems like the type of thing that would be in a Humble Bundle. It's like, yeah, Worms 2.
Sure it would.
Hey, Worms 2 is a fucking great game. That one stands up. Test of time. That got me through lockdown. Worms Armageddon? Worms WMD.
Oh, yeah, WMD.
I was playing that with the lads every Thursday night. It's great.
What was that? Captain Keen. Is it Captain Keen?
I don't know that one.
It's a real early game, like fucking back in the day. It's like before games were games. This is Captain Keen.
Before games were games. Games were men. Real men.
So to our like, you know, viewers who are expecting this shout out to Pokachu. Really looking forward to our skip episode today, but he's not coming. So
And we had some confusion on the timings, and Dad had to go out for cigarettes, so it's gonna be next week.
Yeah, there was a scheduling conflict due to some calendar snafus, so typical gone shit. But they'll be here next week, so you'll be able to enjoy that.
Yeah, and we'll be as incisive as ever, I believe. So, are we going to do a? I think we should do. Are we going to do an awards show? Because that was advertised, right? We said. So the problem was, for those listening, right, we, as professional as we're very professional, obviously, we had a set of topics, and also we have also done some previous years. So, you know, posited on the group chat some topics to the lads, and there was a deafening silence of not giving a shit. Now, I appreciate that we have had, what even fucking year are we in? We have had nearly 3 years of bear market at this point.
You know what it is the fray.
And the excitement maybe is not there. I understand that, but
no,
it's disappointed by the lack of energy. That's what
it's not that. It's not that. It's that the eco is so fucking broad now that it's impossible to be on top of it all. And like, if we're out here trying to like pick things, I mean, we're only picking things out of our own little world. And, you know, I just don't have the energy to go and like educate myself on all of the other bullshit so that we can be like, you know, some kind of accurate, if that makes any sense. I think we're just giving awards to, you know, just random shit.
I would agree with that. Yeah, it feels like as we've all expanded more, there are less things that you can really pinpoint as award worthy, which makes it tough. It's not as fun.
Like our own sphere of the ecosystem is probably just a small fraction. Like we're into the things we're into and we're not all into the same things. And like I might think something's great and you might never have fucking heard of it. So, you know.
That would be a fault of this podcast though. I mean, sorry, that would be a failing of this podcast though, would it not?
No, not really.
Because it's just sort of the forum. This is the forum.
I mean, we're not fucking, we're not a podcast of researchers. We don't sit there just like researching all day. So we're working, doing fucking work. And only sort of, you know, when you're working, you're only interested in the things that make you money and are like, you know, business pertinent to business. You're not on Twitter 25 hours a day fucking scrolling through shit, making notes.
We still make money?
Yeah, there's money to be made.
Yeah.
Somewhere?
Yeah, true.
So, I mean, I don't print it. I don't paint it.
Don't print it. Don't make it. Yeah, fair enough. It's been some time. I think the problem I have more with the award show is it's been quite some time really since all of our eggs as a company, at least in the crypto, because we still obviously do other stuff, weren't kind of in one basket. So it's kind of just like, well, you know, there's only we were always doing fewer chains, and for the longest time only one was making us any money. So it's kind of like, well, we're interested in other things, but you know, the DVT stuff, cool. Does it make us any money? No. You know, it just costs us server costs every month, you know? So there's a whole bunch of things like that, I think, where it's like things you're interested in, but like you can't, I'm not sure you can slap an award on something that's not a good business decision. Although that would eliminate a lot of things in this space. That's not a business decision. You can't give that an award. Okay, well, what are we going to do then? Fair point. To against myself there.
On DVT, though.
On DVT.
I mean, yes. At least it's kind of interesting.
It is kind of interesting. Yeah. Yes.
You're right. It doesn't make any money, but it is kind of interesting.
It doesn't
make any money. It's more of a public service.
It's more of a public service, which is funny because, you know, that would be a good argument if you were working in an area where some people weren't quite literally printing money. So I don't know. Like,
I remember the other day, friend of the podcast hit us up in the group and he's like, you guys are going to be keeping up your, I don't know, I can't remember if it was Lido or SSV cluster or, you know, nodes. And we're like, yeah, man, it was SSV. He was like, yeah, man, we're committed to keeping those things running. And then later on he messaged and he's like, oh yeah, so I've put up a validator on yours guys' nodes. And I'm like, cool. And he's like, yeah, I've bought enough SSV to last 7 years or something. And I'm like, I don't think any of us even charge fees.
How do you even charge fees?
You set the amount of SSV that you want to charge when you set the thing up. And I think I just put 0 or 1 or something like that.
Yeah, SSV per year. Because I am paying the fees for it. So I'm pretty sure.
Okay. So there is some sort of fee. How much are you paying? Yeah. Does it tell you?
It's 1 SSV per node per year.
Okay, so we all must have put in 1 SSV. It must have required something.
You can put 0. You can put 0, Everyone put in 1.
Jeez, I must be flush with SSV now.
I don't think I have any SSV. Oh, well, I guess we will have some SSV.
Don't know how to claim it.
I think it's periodically paid out. I'm not sure, though.
Oh, goodness, man. That was one of those ones where it was set up using quite a bit of automation when we were having a little sleep regression. And, you know, anything that could have been done, anything that was done where it was like the servers and it has alerting in front of it and blah, 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 that was all done with automated deployment stuff. So I'm happy and cool that that all works. And it's got dashboards and whatnot. But everything that was done via that SSV UI, which is also not great, it was just a case of like, put in the numbers,
all the way through.
Yeah, I think it was just like literally me in a chat with Shorty being like, what do all these numbers mean? And Shorty being like, oh, well, yes, here's how you do it. And I'm just like, let's imagine that I am tired and really stupid right now. What number do I put in box B? It's like,
I literally had that.
Don't put in 5. And I'm like, I've put in 5 and hit enter. Schultz is like, no, you've broken it. That's the one number you can put in. That's the last number you should have. You always put, if you don't put 1, you always put 7 because 7 is lucky and it makes the blockchain go faster. And I was like, I'm sorry, I've broken the whole blockchain.
I literally just had that conversation with Zenrock like 3 days ago where we hop on a call and I'm like, okay, imagine I've never used a terminal before and I have a newborn and I'm really tired and I have an IQ of like 8. Now let's continue and try and figure this out. And the guy was like, sweet. And then it was like, I swear to God, it was the single smoothest like paired programming session I've ever had in my life. Not paired programming, but like paired working through something. My God, it was glorious. Treating me like an idiot and everything is deeply smooth. That sounds
fantastic.
I think Zenrock was particularly confusing in some respects. Maybe just because it's different.
It requiring Kubernetes definitely didn't help. And Helm.
Oh, did you use Kubernetes?
Well,
is this recent history we're talking about or a while ago?
No, this was literally like 3 days ago.
Oh, they've got binaries now. They've got binaries.
Well, so
you don't have to use Helm anymore.
Yeah, so this is for their distributed signing, not for the validator.
Oh, right. Oh, fucking. Yeah, so is this like their version of Horcrux or something?
Kind of, but not really. It'd be more like their version of SSV, where it's all separate people signing keys, effectively. But it's not, it's not for the validator. It's for kind of like a different side of their product.
Interesting. Yeah.
I sarcastically note that on their website, they use the word decentralized multiple times and they don't cite sources. They don't even define the word decentralized. My goodness. I'm embarrassed. What does that mean? I wonder if somebody was writing a paper on what that word. I mean, lots of people are writing papers on what that word means. But
I don't even know what you're saying, man.
Fuck if I do, mate.
Fuck. So last night,
you can look forward to this because you got to get through a whole bunch of sleep regressions and then you can do potty training and you're gonna sound as fucking incoherent as I do.
We just got over a sleep regression and. I'm still currently sleeping on the floor of the office during the night. And my partner comes and swaps with me at 3 a.m. and I come and take the morning shift when your man fucking starts to wake up. So last night, Kelly said that the baby was great last night, slept most of the night, you know, good night. And meanwhile, on the floor of the office, I fielded about fucking 50 PagerDuty fucking alarms. She came in at 3 a.m. I'm like, fuck off. I'm wrecked.
Spurious or real? That's a lot of fucking PagerDuty action.
There was this fuck of a network that just kept stalling.
Couldn't be Neutron because it just stalled once for 24 hours or 28 hours.
I kept fixing it and it kept stalling.
Oh, it was Neutron. How did you fix it?
Oh, no. Sorry. It wasn't Neutron. It was a, it was an archive. It's particularly a pain in the butt. And I don't, it's still unclear why, but I've been trying to figure it out with the team. But anyway, it did just keep stalling. So now I've just put my super special little script in there to make it not do that anymore. By way of just restarting it when it stalls. So that's the temporary fix at the moment.
When in doubt.
Yeah, I've actually got that script now as like it goes on all of the servers and just takes arguments. So it's like, you know, this just instead of having to like copy it across and put it into, you know, run it in, I don't know, the background or whatever, you can just, you know, run it straight out of the user bin on every server.
Rewrite it in Rust.
Network's got shit that stalls, apparently.
Rewrite it in Rust, put it in a Docker container, call it production ready, open source it.
You can put bash scripts into user bin and just use this.
I did that. I actually have something very similar that I did use Docker for. Docker is not happy when you try and restart a service outside of it, I'll have you know. In fact, it's very unhappy about that. Now, if you think about it for more than a second, why?
Yeah.
I Docker makes it easy to reproduce. Yeah, basically. Yeah. But I didn't think about the fact that Docker, the kind of the purpose of it is to not interfere with services outside of it. And so I was debugging it for like probably a day, like, what the hell? I know this works. I know it works. I just know it works. It doesn't work. And so I just have to run it natively now.
Ah, yes. So my new friend is just having in Ansible a folder filled with fucking random scripts that I use and then just putting them into the user bin and then just using them. It's great. handy little helpers they are. Maybe I'll call that the role, handy little helpers.
Handy little helpers. User bin, handy little helpers. Hey, you just, like I say, just put all those handy little helpers into a Rust binary, open source it, handylittlehelpers.rs, sell consultancy for your handy little helper service.
Give away the secrets, man. Give away the secret sauce.
The secret sauce is system control restart. We all know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Secret.
Shelling out. I remember like very early in my career as an, like first time I was really doing any ops work over 10 years ago, I was trying to basically get these reproducible things working on some servers. We're moving to Docker. This was when Docker was pre-version one. It was really, really early days. And before Docker Compose, before any of that, when Docker Compose was in like alpha, it was called Fig. That's how long ago this was. And we were running like Ruby on Rails apps and needed to like deploy them with a bunch of like specific to Ruby stuff. And so I wrote this like kind of Ruby wrapper for essentially like sort of Docker deployments remotely that was a little bit inspired by Capistrano. But because of how there wasn't any good way of actually ultimately doing the final bits of orchestration that you needed other than just via the command line. In the end, like, because you obviously there are ways of interacting with the command line via Ruby that use libraries that go like, oh, I'll just call this thing for you or whatever. But then by the time you're writing abstract object classes to like add additional arguments to a thing because it takes more arguments than the developers had thought you'd need or whatever, you just go like system env out. And so like it was this like the command line interface for this Ruby like utility was like actually all right, but then when you dug right way down into the code, eventually it was just like most of the harder Docker stuff was just system out. Like it could have been done by a bash script, and it was just like one of those like, oh, this is cool, we can use this for this and that and the other, and you're just like, just do not look in the internals. You'll realize I've just written a bash script but in Ruby. I sort of proud of that for a little while because I was like, oh, well, it kind of works. And then I thought about it a bit more and I was like, this is fucking stupid. But yeah,
that's kind of all engineering. I quite love bash scripting. I think it's great.
It's great.
That's a pretty hot take. Yeah. Like, there are so many edge cases I can think of, but I couldn't describe like effectively over a video where like you think you're doing it right and then one small syntactical problem ruins it and your day is effectively ruined.
I have never spent so long trying to understand something than reading the fucking bash manual. It's a really long. B, there is so much shit in there. And C, it just does all this stuff that's weird. But I don't know, when you get it humming, it's humming.
If your bash script is longer than about 20 lines and it's not a build script, build scripts are the exception. We allow build scripts. Right, because they get run every build, so if they break we fix them very quickly. It's not a big deal if you have a big scary silly build script. People freak out about that too much. But any other situation, your bash script is longer than like
I definitely want to say
30 lines. think 30 lines is the length of bash script where I look at it and I go, that's going to cause problems. Something like that. It's about like, it's about basically like one page, you know, without tabbing down in the terminal. If you just less it and it's about a page, you're like, okay, that's fine. I'm all right with that. And if it has like the little arrow down, I'm like, no. I think this might be doing too much. And I start to get that little tingling in the palms of your hands where you know something bad's going to happen at some point.
So I do have a script that is exactly 99 lines long. So yeah, I get over the 20.
I think I've got one that's like 400.
Yeah, definitely have longer ones. This is just the first one I clicked on.
Eek.
In my defense, a lot of it is logging. So
yeah.
I mean, it would have to be 300 lines of logging for you to even get to null's size.
It might actually be. For every function, I have the massive manual block of like six lines of this is what's doing in this function. So,
fair enough.
Oh, like actual code comments. Code.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Juno build scripts were probably about 200 lines long back in the day. But then I guess that was building a valid Genesis file, building the chain, launching the chain, uploading some smart contracts, making some accounts, making everything work, and then going like, does it all work now? So that was a kind of, yeah, I would say if you just looked at that, like a propo nothing, you'd probably be like, this is fucking insanity. But then at the same time, like, I think Reese wasn't scared by it when he looked at it. I don't know what that says about the script. It might, you know. Yeah, maybe tentatively roll back my harshness about the length of bash scripts. We'll see.
I do quite enjoy in bash that like most of the exits from blocks, like a case block, the exit is ESAC. and if it's like fire, for example, just keeps going. Anyway, it's a love of mine.
Okie doke.
Moving on.
Anyway, moving on. That's a good... I'm glad that you enjoy your ESACs. You've got to have something to keep your spirits up in these trying times.
Yeah. It's the little things that, you know, really make life
like
worth
the word case backwards, in fact.
The ESAC and the fire.
Shit, it's like, we've got a thing for this. It's pay your taxes time here. Like, have you reported them and then you need to pay them for companies, which means that it's the time of year where I look at our 5-year financials and remember just how much we lost by staking in Cosmos. And so that's fun as well. So I think in the chat earlier, Rama was like, we're still in a bear where, and it's like, well, you know, it's all relative, right? Remember, Juno was $40 once. And so, you know, if you stake that Juno here.
I think gauging overall market sentiment on the price of Juno is a little bit misplaced.
Well, no, you should probably gauge it on fucking Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, or like, you know, anything else. I guess just a random meme coin on Solana would probably be better.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. Probably like, you know, if you look at like the top 20, like Jenkins, like if you look at maybe like Ethereum, Bitcoin, let's say, because they kind of are in a class of their own in terms of what they do, although correlated, obviously. And then, you know, some, do you know what they're, and they're obviously, as soon as I think about this, they're obviously like 1,000, there'd be 1,000 research papers on this, on how you actually classify what the market's doing in terms of altcoins and also Bitcoin and Ethereum. I could just look it up. Maybe I will. But I guess like from our point of view, the thing that's most relevant to the majority of validators, given that it's purely like Ethereum is just like a margins game. The altcoins are always going to be where the future of our businesses as validators are, right? Because they're the only ones that can have an upside to taking on counterparty risk, essentially. Because the parties are over in the other places.
The parties are over?
Well,
it's like trying to elbow into Solana right now, right? you can jump in and pay your 2 Solana, 15 Solana a month just to run your node. But now it's $250 per Solana or whatever it is, versus when the starter is like 30 cents each, right?
Yeah. Party sounds like over. That needs an adjustment. Is there a lot of Solana validators?
Hundreds, many hundreds, maybe even thousands. Many, many, many.
All paying, what did you say, 15 Solana a month?
About 15 a month, yeah.
So like that's $3,000?
Yeah. You have to pay in order to like validate transactions, because in Solana, a transaction is how you sign. And so for every, you know, 0.2 second block, you're doing a transaction.
Mm.
And every other validator is also doing a transaction. It's one of the ways that they kind of like game the system for their how much transactions they're getting through on the network. Because if there's 1,000 validators and they're doing a transaction, then suddenly they're saying they're doing, you know, 5,000 transactions per second, when all that is doing is moving a block one forward.
Yeah. I remember actually that's similar to Say when you looked at the stats on Say when they first were launched, there was like, you know, 40 transactions per block, which is, you know, 120 transactions per second, which was just like the Oracle. Yeah.
It's like the...
Add that up over 120 million blocks. That's a lot of transactions.
Yeah, but the point stands. Getting in on those established networks is... There's not much point, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and, you know, even with like these Cosmos SDK or other altcoin networks, after the initial launch, it is really hard to break into anyway, even just weeks or a month after, because most of the initial staking is done in that period. And then it's pretty hard to move stake from people after they do that. A lot of people just set it and forget it, collect their rewards or whatever. So,
I mean, a great example of that is the validator, the so-called Skip validator on the hub right now. They rebranded. I don't remember what they were before.
Oh, yeah. It was something 3S in 3S or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. And they changed to Skip whenever Skip rebranded to Interchain Labs.
Interchain Inc. Right. Sorry. Yeah, Interchain Inc.
Well, regardless, validator rebranded.
We can ask next week.
Yeah, we can. Yeah. Validator rebranded and changed their commission to 100%, and very few people have left. And they have 200,000 Atom staked to them.
Yeah, I think over the years, like a few people have pulled that move, haven't they? There was that, I can't remember the name of them. They did it and they're like, oh, it was a mistake. And then we're like, oh, we'll reduce it at like 1% a day for the next 100 days or something.
Yeah, I'm surprised they could ramp it up that quickly, because you have like a maximum day change. You have a maximum change, don't you, with the time?
Yeah, the funny thing is that the maximum change applies to going up, not down. Yeah. So they had the ability to change it all at once.
That's funny. I assumed it was bi-directional. So today I learned something new about the Cosmos SDK.
I think that's how it works anyway, from memory.
I mean, yeah. The more toxic thing is going up, so you would assume that that would be the way it was implemented. But I guess I just assumed it was both. But
that could need some fact checking.
could need just a little bit of fact checking, but that's fine. Anyway, so Skip next week, that'll be good.
Yeah, there's quite a few things actually. I think it's probably not so bad having them next week anyway, so we can make an appropriate episode name, give a little bit of advertising, do a little bit more research, because they're into quite a few things. And I'm wondering if they still have, like, because being Interchain Inc., I guess the Cosmos stack is their primary, you know, product now or objective. But I'm just wondering what happens also with all their other products that they have throughout the Cosmos, which they had been working on previously. So be good to get some more questions armed up around those types of projects and what that means for them. Presumably they'll continue on with them, but
I'm curious how the acquisition worked. Like, are they acquiring the entire team as an acqui-hire so that they can specifically work on the Cosmos SDK, or what? I doubt they're going to talk about it, but I just find those things really interesting.
Well, I noticed some emails are still Skip emails and some are Interchain Inc. emails. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe they've got like a Skip team within Interchain Inc. now, like maybe a division. the skip division? Who knows? We can ask.
Did speaking of acquihires, we also saw a long-standing validator is now out of the game.
Oh,
yeah,
that was news. So Friends has been, I want to say, acquired by Restake Validator.
I didn't realize Restake was big enough to acquire anybody, really. But that was sort of a surprise.
So I don't know that I've ever heard of the actual Restake Validator before. And looking at their list of networks that they support, maybe they're reasonably new to the Cosmos.
Right, because it's like Sui and a handful of others, right?
I think I saw some Solana. I'm not sure if I saw Sui. A grab bag of other Cosmos SDK networks. But I guess that was their way of making an entry easier to the eco. Just have someone who's already got a few validators around. Yeah, and I see that Yuri has actually. Oh shit! I saw that Yuri has actually joined their team as well from Friends. So maybe like a merger type situation. Not 100% sure.
Well, Friends was trying to sell like a year ago. I remember reading their pitch deck for why they're selling. So I do imagine it was acquisition. I think they were trying to get out, right? Why would they have a deck if they weren't trying to sell? So I bet it's some sort of like golden handcuff type of thing where they want to maintain the connections for a year or two, and then the founder of Friends will bounce once that's over.
How did you happen across that? Was it like did they contact you or?
No. I don't remember. It was shared in like a dev group.
In a what group?
A business development group.
Ah, right. Chat. Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Mel's like, I'll buy that for $1.
Yeah, I was just reading these comments from Rama. So Rama says that Skip is Interchain Inc. now. Skip doesn't exist anymore. All the investors were paid out. Skip now has $350 million of Interchain Foundation funds.
Well, that just kind of raises more questions for me. Like, how were they bought? Were they bought by the chain? Were they bought by the Cosmos? Because I didn't vote on that, right? Like, what happened and how?
Skip now has the 350. Does that mean the Skip investors got paid out $350 million, or that the new Interchain Inc. is sitting on a treasury of $350 million?
Well, I mean, I guess no offense, but like Skip wasn't. It would have been if somebody was paid out, it would have been at the market rate of Skip, which would have been a couple of $1 million, right, max. Because it's just knowledge and people, right?
Yeah, sure. What I meant more was like, what's the system for how that worked, right? Like, it wasn't bought using the community funds, right? Right on the actual chain.
Oh, I think Rama's answered you in the comments, which is that ICF is an independent organization.
Okay, so Skip was bought by the ICF. Okay.
Yes, yeah, so ICF is, I think.
Well, it must have been some money involved, but was also a merger, because the original ICF is now named something different after the merger. Because wasn't it Interchain.io, and now it's Interchain Inc.
It was Interchain GmbH, because it was based in Germany, wasn't it?
Okay, and now it's a.
I only know that because I had to reference the Tendermint documentation repeatedly in one of my papers, and so I had to find out who I was referencing, what company, and I'm pretty certain it was a GmbH company. Although that's probably out of date, because that would have been last September when I wrote those references. But I'm damned if I'm going back and reformatting my BibTeX. Oh, no. that file is done. Yeah. Just because Cosmos shit is continually changing because of this, that, and the other, doesn't mean my references are going to get messed with. That shit took ages, and they're done. So
yeah, I definitely remember the pain of referencing, the Harvard referencing. Yeah.
It's not so. It is less bad if you use LaTeX, but I didn't for my first draft. I just fucking bashed it out in one caffeinated, psychopathic effort 20,000 words or whatever in Google Docs and then had to refine it down to 10 and then reformat it in LaTeX, which was stupid. Just write if okay, so here's all right, pro tip. Anybody listening to the podcast, you're going to do any kind of academic work, even undergraduate, to be perfectly honest, just start by learning LaTeX and just do it in a LaTeX editor. Just don't bother wasting your time, because you can just get pre-formatted BibTeX files of every paper that's published in any kind of non Mickey Mouse journal, or even ones that are independently uploaded to archive. You can just get a BibTeX reference and stick it in and move on with your life. And Overleaf is a good way to start. It's free. It's online. You can access it via your institution. Don't be like this guy and write the whole fucking paper and then have to refine it and then have to reformat it. It is demoralizing as fuck. Don't do that.
Little D says, just use ChatGPT to convert to LaTeX.
That's a horrifying suggestion. Please don't do that. yes.
So on the subject of ChatGPT, recent subscriber right here, two thumbs up, and have also started using Copilot. And I don't know why I didn't jump on the train earlier. It's quite handy, that shit.
It's glorious. It makes everything, well, not everything, easier. I think that the real foot gun at this point is having the knowledge to know when things are wrong.
Yeah, like, that is definitely a point, because it quite frequently will feed you some bullshit. But
yeah,
you know,
very overconfident. I mean, that's the point, right?
Yeah, but it's good for scaffolding. So, and it's good for small changes. So, you know, say for example, Ginger 2 is quite confusing when you have a large Ginger 2 template, and say you want to like change or add in like a, say you have a really long template and it's got a bunch of loops in there to like bring things in depending on if they're defined and that type of stuff, and you want to add in like another check, you could just select it all and tell it to add in another check for this thing. And if you're like pretty precise with your prompt, it'll do it and do it well. If you're not precise with your prompt, it may do something else.
I mean, it sounds like you just created something very bad, which maybe is the whole point of why, but it's fine, because it's fine.
What do you mean created something bad? Explain yourself.
So you just described nested loops, I think, which, you know, are generally pretty
bad. Well, Ginger is a templating language. It's not a
I'm aware of what Ginger is, Null. I used to work in Python.
Yeah, but, you know, is there a different way to do it?
Well, you can obviously abstract out some logic so that you don't have to do nested loops, and you can also do things like list comprehensions and, you know, intermediate functions. Like, there are lots of other ways of breaking out abstractions of things that need computing or checking in kind of, because a lot of what you'd be doing is guard clauses, and actually it sounds like you're doing unnecessary iteration, and that sounds like exactly the sort of thing that you can probably get ChatGPT to like come up with a solution for you. But it's back to Schulze's foot gun thing. In fact, it's exactly, I am just reiterating at longer length and more confused, because I have had a 10-hour day and then gone to a networking thing and then come on the podcast and I have no words left. I am just copying Schulze's homework of what he already said literally a minute ago. So I'll just say Schulze already said the thing about the foot gun and the wrong and the.
Okay, so Copilot's great for doing dumb shit then, if that's what you're into.
I think it also depends on the environment you're in, I guess.
Well, when you're templating in Ansible, you only have so many fucking options. And, you know, I don't see a way around it. I'd love to have you take a look at it and you can tell me exactly.
Schulze had a point to make just there before I interrupted him.
Well, I was going to go off on a bit of a segue, so that Noel's continue on this topic. I'm totally
no, do it. Segue out.
Well, this is irrelevant to the podcast, but I'm still kind of connected to my my alma mater, and ChatGPT, I think, is really damning for oncoming software engineers. They one just the existence of it means that junior engineers kind of having a hard time getting jobs. But two, they don't know enough to know not to trust ChatGPT, and they can't kind of like intuit what's wrong with their answers, like ChatGPT's answers. And I think that that's a serious, serious problem that incoming software engineers have to deal with.
Yeah, it's fucking, that's okay. Yeah, that's, I was literally having a variant of that conversation earlier with, because not with university links, but I still obviously do consulting and things in like trad tech stuff. And as somebody who's done a lot of hiring before, I guess like I, especially like former colleagues and whatnot, they've just gone on the traditional career and engineering career ladder while, you know, we were off being DGens over here. But I guess I still just about can like resuscitate somebody else's opinion as my own to nod along with these conversations of people who have responsible real jobs in tech. But that is like something that has come up a fair bit, is that it's that, yeah, like that intuition, like you said, that you kind of, you just build up as like work it, like, what's the term I'm looking for? Journeyman. You know, like when you had craftspeople in like olden times, you had like a novice apprentice and then you had a journeyman, and they would literally journey between different master craftspeople and like learn from them and build up their own intuition of how to create the outcome they were looking for, whether that was a chair or a desk or a horse-drawn carriage or whatever. And it was only when they became the idea of a master work, you know, is sort of like you cannot be a master crafts person until you come up with your master work, right? And it's not possible unless you go through all the pain of the iterative steps to build up the reasoning of how to practically do these things, because there's obviously book learning and yada, 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 but a lot of it is intuited, especially, yeah, in the past. And a lot of people have made the connection between software engineering or programming, you know, programming as it is outside of a big company, I suppose. And that kind of style of learning and progression. And certainly, at least for me, that's the progression that I went on from junior to senior to whatever, took that shape. And I saw it in people that I managed and mentored and whatever. And I think it's quite a good model. And actually, yeah, and that's the thing I kind of worry about, like, I suppose with those sort of things. It's like similar to what you were saying, Shorty, is that like if you don't build that intuition early, then you really don't have a foundation for much to build upon, because you're always just building feedback loops for intuitive processes that are usually below your conscious brain. And then the bit that the conscious brain is doing is usually the feedback loops around learning and problem solving, which are like how you gather enough information for your brain to then synthesize the solution. And that's quite a different problem space from the one that your subconscious is working on. And the subconscious one only gets fed by experience. And ChatGPT is basically shortcutting that intuitive leap. It's shortcutting that aha moment.
Yeah, exactly. I think that coding boot camps are an interesting example of that, where I know there's a lot of criticism of coding boot camps, but some of the best engineers I've encountered came from them. And I think that a coding boot camp will be a particularly bad spot for AI usage, not to their fault, just that I've gone through them as like kind of as an exercise to see what it looks like. And a lot of them, you know, they do kind of advanced topics fairly quickly and they don't delve deep enough. And so it would be such an easy out to just be like, okay, well, I'm not seeing this, blah, 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 blah. How do I don't know, convert HTML using CSS to make this widget bigger, as an example.
That's, yeah. So like instead of thinking harder on the thing, you just get something else to do it.
Well, but also sometimes it might genuinely be beyond you at that point. So around the time I got my first job as a programmer, I mainly worked on front end stuff, and I did some Ruby on Rails stuff. But, you know, Ruby on Rails is relatively straightforward within its own framework. Like you can do a lot of back end stuff without having to know how it all fits together. And I kind of knew I had this like big gap in my knowledge, right? I had this very applied knowledge of like decent HTML, CSS, JavaScript, okay at Ruby, okay. And so I did one of those, you know, CS 101 there wasn't the MIT courseware. It might have been like Udacity back in the day. I can't remember. And I remember doing like the basically you work through an assignment. The whole course was gradually working through an assignment where you essentially built a first a recreation of the original Google PageRank algorithm. That was what it was working up to, and it was done in Python. Come full circle to what would I know about Python anyway? And I really, really distinctly remember like the thing that sticks with me about that process is all the failures, right? Because, and what was really interesting about it is like you were saying, Shorty, about when you get dumped into a topic area where it's actually the gap between where you are and where the topic area is potentially too wide. I was working as a developer at that point, and I couldn't. There were some bits of that algorithm, especially more complicated parts, which I actually like couldn't figure out. And if there had been ChatGPT there, I probably would have been able to get from A to B and solve it, but I wouldn't have had any understanding. And what ended up happening was some of the final, I think I did get through it, and then I went on to the follow-up and I literally got brick walled by it. And I couldn't do the next iteration of it. So I think I finished the CS101, but I didn't finish the 252, which was the follow-up. And then several years pass. And then I'm working on a problem, which is a graph problem when I work for a data consultancy. And I realized I was working on the problem that I had seen and failed at and never finished like several years before. And obviously in that context, I actually kind of by that point did know what I was doing, solved it, because it's part of my working day, had to be done, and then just went back and looked it up out of curiosity and was like, fuck me, no wonder I couldn't figure this out at the time. But then had, you know, a very belated aha moment looking at it and going, oh yeah, no, actually no, but I see where my reasoning was going with what I've tried to do here, and I was going completely the wrong direction. That's not how you solve this. Fine. But it's that, you know, sometimes learning something can be in the post for a very long time, and maybe this is just me, I'm a very slow learner, so this is like very typical of like I don't understand something and then like years later, like fucking Cosmos pre-commits, man, that just whoosh, 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 for the longest time, like, well, I was actually working on Juno core, just whoosh, whoosh. And then like years later you're just like, oh yeah, okay, mempools, everybody keeps talking about mempools, and it's not until a long time later when you're like, but what are the essential components of building a blockchain? And you're like, you build a blockchain in your head from first principles and you always end up with a mempool, and you're like, you know, there's a lot of things in life like that. That's what I'm saying. And if you can shortcut the reasoning required to understand why you need a mempool, you end up building a blockchain without a mempool and then just be like, oh fuck, we need a mempool. Like, I don't know. That's probably a bad example.
Well, I get it though. It's like, you need to have that difficulty in order to overcome it, and not being able to let things simmer because you get an instant gratification answer is not doing yourself, like, you're doing yourself a disservice to a certain extent. Like at this point, like, no, I'm not criticizing you directly in any way, shape or form. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be using ChatGPT.
This is like 25 minutes. This has been purely criticizing you now for the last 25 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. All for using Copilot and ChatGPT. Now, for us running a business and we need to use that as like a periphery of what we're actually doing, like who cares, right? Like it's solving something.
It works.
If, 100%. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But for someone that's still building up their core strengths in order to create their career, that's where I think it can be a damning tool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to make a career in fucking programming, but I mean,
I make a career in degeneracy, baby.
Yeah, it suits our purpose, even if it's doing the wrong thing. Even if I'm doing the wrong thing, it works perfectly for what I need it for. So, you know, I don't have the benefit of being a programmer for the last fucking 20 years. So if I do things a little wrong, fuck it. I like it because it works. But
I use it as well. I have subscribed to it for like the last, I don't know, 12 months, 18 months. I use it mostly for like APIs. I don't like researching APIs. I'll just be like, hey, how do I send this over here? And then it'll be like, boom. And I'll be like, cool.
I find most useful for
other people's APIs with shit documentation. God damn.
I find it most useful for like brainstorming ideas on how to solve a problem anyway. I use it a bit in VS Code for helping me just quickly change shit. But in like, you know, if I got like a more complex problem with what I'm trying to do, I'll just talk to it for like an hour and say, you know, start off with my issue and then explore with it the options it thinks is the way to do things, and then maybe come up with a scaffold of how I want to attack that problem and then start trying to attack it. But I find it quite handy for that type of stuff. Not so much Copilot, but definitely ChatGPT. So
you're basically pair programming with it.
Yeah, because, you know, I don't have the benefit of years of programming, and I'm still learning. So it's quite handy for that. Thinking out a problem, I guess.
I've got out of pure curiosity, this will take longer, but put a little mascot or a duck or something on your desk.
And ask the duck.
I knew that's where that was coming. I was going to say, this sounds just like Rubber Ducky debugging to me.
It would take longer, but see whether you get to the same solution and whether there's a difference in satisfaction. I really can't talk today. Satisfaction. I'd be really, really interested, because like I've literally got on my desk here, I talked to Totoro, and in Totoro's little bag, I also have the Buddha in case Totoro ain't cutting it. And you need to appeal to a higher authority. You ask the Buddha. And if you need the highest authority of all, you got President Business. In case you really need, with a little light.
This is what my Tanuki's for.
Exactly. You're just like, President Business, can you help me? I can't solve this thing.
Okay, so what is asking the thing going to get for me? Explain.
Oh, right. So the point is, you're always... the solution is always going to come from your hindbrain, right? It's going to come from an intuitive leap. So what you're always trying to do is feed data to your brain to synthesize the problem and then make the intuitive leap to solve it. So by ideating out loud, you iterate towards a solution, even in the absence of somebody talking back to you. So my thesis here, right, is that ChatGPT is useful, but the majority of the usefulness is your own brain chewing the problem. And I'm just naively curious, I suppose, whether you could get the same result from describing your problem out loud to an inanimate object and letting your subconscious figure it out. Because that's what junior developers were taught to do when me and George were coming up.
I think in some instances, yes, and other instances, no, because I don't necessarily have all of the inputs required to be able to make the intuitive leap. For example, like there might be a technology or a software that I'm just not aware of and wouldn't be able to arrive at on my own. A method even that's employed by a particular software or package or something that I don't know about. I might need to do something, but not think that it's possible with what is already sloshing around, just because I don't have the breadth of knowledge already to arrive at that. But, you know, if it's just a logic problem or something like that within a program, probably, yeah, I would assume that type of stuff I'd probably just think on anyway while I'm like taking a shit. So I'd ask the dunny.
Always ask the dunny if you're stuck.
Yeah. Yes, shits quite often take an hour and a half instead of 10 minutes just because I'm staring at the corner of the shitter thinking.
And you too could have this problem if you decide to take the exciting career choice of being a validator.